This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and happy Friday, everyone. We're going to begin today with our week in review and the decision by the government to seek the death penalty for Jahar Tsarnaev, the accused Marathon bomber. Many in this anti-death penalty state oppose the decision, but not former Boston FBI Special Agent Rick DeLaurier, who ran the case.
The death penalty should be given as an option to the jury to consider. I totally support that decision.
Boston's new mayor, Marty Walsh, was more hesitant.
As a state representative, I voted against the death penalty. If I were to ask to vote on that today, I would vote the same way. But this is not my vote to cast or my decision to make.
And earlier this week, Governor Deval Patrick delivered his final State of the Commonwealth address and said the state needs to rebuild the ladder of economic success.
Because there are children here in our own Commonwealth tonight whose future is still defined by the zip code of their birth.
And a spike in deadly gun violence in the city prompted Boston police to reach out to the clergy to help stop the bloodshed.
We intend to go forward together and help fix the quality of life in the city of Boston, because obviously not everyone's getting that message.
All those stories and more with our Week in Review panel. This week we're joined from the Boston Globe by politics editor Jim O'Sullivan. Hi, Jim. Good to have you back.
Thanks very much for having me.
Also, here in the studio, John Carroll joins us. He's a professor of communications and writes the Campaign Outsider blog. And John Carroll, happy Friday to you.
Nice to be here.
So let's start with this decision by Attorney General Eric Holder to pursue the death penalty case against the accused Boston Marathon bomber. And for this part of the Week in Review, I want to also welcome Harvard Law School professor and former federal judge Nancy Gertner. And hello, Nancy. Welcome back to the program. Great to have you.
Great to be here.
And I'd love to start with you, Nancy. You heard there from the mayor, who seems to be speaking for a city and a state that's still pretty divided over the use of the death penalty, even for such a heinous crime as this. What does this mean for the shape of the trial to come?
It so dramatically complicates the trial. The judge has to pick a jury that is, as they just say, death qualified. The jury that hears the did he do it part of the trial has to be, quote, death qualified, because if they conclude he did it, they go on to determine if he gets the death penalty. With numbers at 57% opposed to the death penalty in this case, it will be very difficult to select a jury. And in addition, the government is describing this, and it may well be the right description, that Boston was the victim, not an individual, not someone separately singled out. So if Boston is the victim, selecting a jury in Boston will be very, very difficult. Mm.
So this is going to draw it out, make it more expensive, make it longer to prosecute, it sounds like.
By dimensions. I had a street crime case that the government sought the death penalty in, and it seems to me that the trial of that was probably 10 times as long as it otherwise would have been. Hmm.
We spoke to prosecutors, former federal prosecutors yesterday, most of whom said they were not surprised by this decision. Were you at all surprised?
Well, I was somewhat surprised. I was hoping that in this state we would say that this was a terribly heinous crime, but civilized societies don't kill people under these circumstances. I was hoping for that, but I was not surprised that we didn't get it. I might add that I was surprised a little bit by the notice of the death penalty here. There was a remark in there about how Tsarnaev didn't show remorse. Well, as of the moment that he was arrested, he had a right to remain silent. The government can't be commenting about anything that he did or said after he was arrested. They don't know one way or the other, at least from this distance. And there was also a line about how he was a naturalized citizen and it was a breach of trust. A naturalized citizen shouldn't get a more substantial penalty than an ordinary citizen.
Hmm.
It's the same trust in both cases.
Well, Jim Sullivan, I want to come to you. The Globe editorialized today against the decision, writing in part, a death penalty prosecution instead raises the likelihood that the trial will drag on much longer, keep the city's wounds raw, and that he'll eventually get the martyrdom he apparently sought. Say more about that and your view about this decision this week.
Well, I'm on the news side, so we're separate from the editorial
page. Of course
page.
You are, yeah. So, sorry for putting you in that position.
No problem. But that's certainly a valid view held by, you know, a lot of people, that it will make it This is going to be a long, emotional trial regardless. I think, you know, coming up on the one-year anniversary, I sat down with the governor a few weeks ago, and he talked about the word he used was the intensity around the anniversary, not just emotionally, but security-wise and all the logistics that are going to that. So we're gearing up regionally, you know, municipally, as a city, as anyone who sort of experienced this and went through this. There are emotional hurdles yet to come, and I think it's going to intensify it for a lot of people. On this issue, I think if you looked at the initial reactions of some of the politicians, and that's sort of my beat, some of them were almost unintelligible, because there was, you know, Governor Patrick has this personal relationship with not just the president, but also with the Attorney General, Eric Holder, so he wouldn't want to embarrass his friend. At the same time, you have the sort of the visceral anger of people who lived through that and who know people who lived through that. So it's a dicey, I think, politically line to walk here.
Yeah, John, I'd love to bring you into this conversation. What about this idea of martyrdom, that a death penalty trial could raise that as a sort of issue around this trial?
It's possible. There's a lot of emotion around just even the photographs of Jawahar Tsarnaev. So I think that's possible. From a legal standpoint, I mean, I got my law degree from Jerry Orbach University, so I have no idea about that. But I have been led to believe that sometimes the death penalty is used to negotiate a plea. And so it may actually bring this to a quicker end than it might otherwise have. But I think that they're all concerns. And you can argue this one round, you can argue it flat. I think most Bostonians in a poll said they oppose the death penalty in this situation, which I think makes it doubly hard for them to impanel a jury.
Nancy, what about that point that John raised, the possibility that this could provide a quicker route to a plea?
I think that that's, of course, possible, but anyone who dealt with this case from the moment it started knew that that was the route. Mm-hmm. In other words, you didn't need this ceremony of recommending that this was a death penalty case for that. You know, the papers reporting the nature of the evidence in this case, if there's nothing much to try, then that's an option regardless of the death penalty. And, you know, I keep on saying this, but It seems to me that it should matter that this state doesn't have a death penalty and was against, that this state, this city that suffered mightily during this was opposed to the death penalty. It should have mattered to the Attorney General.
Of course, as we know, this isn't unprecedented. I mean, the feds have brought death penalty cases in states that oppose the death penalty, including Massachusetts. So it's not unprecedented, is it?
It's not at all unprecedented, but it's a judgment call. And it seems to me that the judgment of the community should have weighed in that in some measure.
All right. Well, that's Nancy Gertner. She's a former federal judge. She's now a professor at Harvard University Law School. Nancy Gertner, as always, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this. All right. And gentlemen, let's move on to the governor, who delivered his final State of the Commonwealth address this week. His speech wasn't big on new initiatives, but he did reflect on the past 7 years. Let's listen.
Budgets are balanced. Our rainy day fund is one of the strongest in the country, and we have the highest bond rating in Commonwealth history. And today in Massachusetts, you can marry whomever you love.
The governor also talked about economic opportunity or an economic divide. We heard in the open, he said that there are children here in our own Commonwealth tonight whose future is still defined by the zip code of their birth. So, Jim, a couple of different directions there. Your thought on the governor's final State of the Commonwealth address?
I thought it was a strong assertion of his relevance. Now, what does that mean? Why does he have to make that strong assertion? Because there's a sense on Beacon Hill that you know, and this is probably natural for any governor in his final year, that there's a sense of sort of growing disengagement where a lot of people have left the administration, where the agenda is sort of tuckered out. He realizes that the legislature isn't going to give him any sort of significant new revenue. A lot of the things that he would have liked to have done, he would call them investments in his final year, in early education, in higher education, in transportation projects. The money's just not going to be there for some of those expanded government programs. So he came out, and he was sort of a love letter to the state, a thank you for letting me do this, thank you for having done this with me for the last 7 years. And his insistence is that he's going to, quote, run through the tape. It's sort of a point of pride with him, and has been throughout, I think, his administration, that he's going to serve out the two terms Right. The last governor to do that here was Mike Dukakis. We had sort of a string of governors taking off and looking for other jobs. So I think it was his assertion of that. And also, like you said, it was a little light on policy. Some of the things he's talked about, such as early ed, such as an investment in higher education that would allow for a tuition freeze at state colleges and universities, those are in his budget. And the budget is on its way to being rewritten by the legislature.
And John, of course, a much less ambitious agenda laid out this week than compared to a year ago. What did you hear in the governor's speech?
Right. Well, it may be a love letter. It may be a Dear John letter, too. You never know. I think it's obviously less ambitious. Last time around, he was going for $1.9 billion tax hike, I believe. Got about, I don't know, a quarter of it. This is less ambitious. I think it's about legacy shaping at this point. And interestingly, just in the clip that we heard, two of the things that he cited there are completely out of his hands. You know, a governor has to balance the budget. It's in the Constitution, the state Constitution. And also, you know, same-sex marriage. He hadn't really... I don't know what he had to do with that. That was the Supreme Judicial Court. So I think
he helped defend it when it came before the legislature.
Well, yeah, sure.
He helped work votes.
Okay, fair enough. So I think that's something on his mind. But I think that one of the things he didn't address necessarily was some of the real difficulties and challenges and failures of his two terms. And I think that really stood out, that he sort of glossed over.
And what do you put on top of that list?
Well, I would put right now the Department of Children and Families. Mm-hmm. Right now, I would put the state drug lab. That was a complete disaster. I think that Deval Patrick sometimes gives off the impression that he's a second responder, and I think he shows up late on the scene quite often, and I think that's something that's going to detract from his legacy. I think there are many good things. Don't get me wrong. I mean, there are a number of good things that he did, but I just think it's a kind of a high wire act at this point.
I want to talk a little bit about this whole issue of income inequality. It was interesting. We talked about this this week on our show, that the governor spoke, of course, just before President Obama delivered his State of the Union address. Both men hit on the theme of economic inequality and the minimum wage. So here's Governor Patrick.
Raising the minimum wage would bring a little relief to the working poor, many of whom do jobs we could not live without, and who, by the way, will recycle that money right back into the economy. To those who are reluctant to raise the minimum wage, I ask only that before you resolve to oppose it, consider whether you can live on it.
I thought that was a powerful moment in that speech. But Jim O'Sullivan, the idea of economic inequality, as we mentioned, a theme in both the governor's and the president's speeches, so was the minimum wage. Right. But what can a governor do, really, even as the president struggles to balance the economic scales?
Right. Well, that's the paradox, right? When they want the bully pulpit, the governors talk about income inequality and a reasonable and equitable economy. And then when the economy declines, they say, well, there's only so much a governor can do. Mm-hmm. I think one way to look at this is in the context of where the Democratic Party is heading. Generally, it's heading more toward that Elizabeth Warren style of rhetoric, which is about inequality and sort of more populist than we've seen in the past under the party as it was defined by during the Clinton-Gore era. It was sort of a more corporate style party. It's not just Democrats. You know, you see a lot of the Tea Party movement, obviously on the opposite end of the ideological spectrum, but a lot of that was fed by economic anxiety and this idea that there are the haves and have-nots. Ultimately, I think, a governor can set a sort of rhetorical climate and tinker around a little bit with policy and on the margins. That's why you see a lot of Patrick's investments go into things like early ed and higher ed and human services. But ultimately, there are only so many levers of power in a corner office, I think.
I want to just play a clip from President Obama from the same night, from the State of the Union address, because it's just interesting how he echoed the same theme and in much the same ways by first sort of saying, hey, things are a lot better. The stock market's going, the economy's building, people are going back to work. However, even in spite of all that, he said this.
Inequality has deepened. Upward mobility has stalled. The cold hard fact is that even in the midst of recovery, too many Americans are working more than ever just to get by, let alone to get ahead. And too many still aren't working at all. So our job is to reverse these trends.
So, John, you know, is this in general this theme? Is it a winning theme for Democrats?
It's a tricky theme for Democrats, and they've been having a big debate over what kind of language they want to use. There's income inequality. President Obama tended to use opportunity more than income inequality. So you have these sort of two branches of the Democratic Party. One is the red meat populist, as Jim said, you know, Elizabeth Warren wing. And the other is a wing that is concerned about, and it's usually red state Democrats, who are concerned about this sort of class warfare component that income inequality always brings up. And that's the potential backlash for it. So I think that they're trying to thread the needle in a way to appeal to their constituents in a way that's powerful, but also not to give ammunition to the Republicans, not to sort of spark a sidebar of class warfare that would actually work to their detriment.
Yeah, tricky balancing act there. Well, let's move on to the recent spate of deadly violence that has hit the city. Most recently last weekend, 4 young people killed in Dorchester and Mattapan and suspected gang violence. 9 people have been killed this month. The Boston police quickly reached out to religious leaders in Boston to help stop the violence. Here's Reverend Gary Adams from the Morning Star Baptist Church in Mattapan.
1 is too much, but 9 in 1 month is pretty outrageous. It is something that in many ways can hold a community hostage. That's why it is so important that we address this urgently and that we realize that there has to be solidarity here with the clergy, with the community, with the police department, with the city.
Now, Jim, of course, Mayor Walsh has made responding to violence in the city his top priority. But what do you make of the response so far and of this latest string of killings?
Well, I don't think anybody would say anytime you have 9 in the first month of the year, any kind of response would be insufficient. And I mean, we've struggled with this for decades, you know, and that they've never every time we think we've solved the riddle with, you know, the Boston Miracle, there's sort of a backsliding. So for the mayor, it's a big challenge, and he talks about it a little bit differently in his rhetoric. I've noticed both the when he talks about public health issues like substance abuse and about violence, he talks a lot about not just the immediate victimhood, but the trauma that goes along with that for the victim, for the family, for the community. So it kind of gives the idea that he's looking at it a little bit differently.
Yeah. John, Jim mentioned sort of backsliding there from the days of the Boston Miracle when it seemed like the city really had a grip on this problem. Your thoughts on the way the city is dealing with this intractable challenge?
It's disheartening in many ways because the response is the same. The players are the same. It's almost formulaic at this point. And you keep going through this same sort of drill after these things happen. And they're terrible things that are happening. It's tragic. And you wonder, what is it that's going to make a difference? I think Marty Walsh talking about trauma counseling is interesting. I'm not sure that...
It's interesting, but it's dealing with the fact after the violence has been committed. And, of course, it's important to have to marshal those kinds of resources, but it doesn't get at the root cause of the violence.
Exactly. And also what you've got is you've got education problems, you've got economic problems, you've got all kinds of root problems that that aren't being addressed in many ways. And so I think that this is a sort of a syndrome that that the city officials, community leaders are trapped in, and the residents, too, of these neighborhoods of Boston. And I think that it runs so deep that it's really hard to see how you get out onto the other side of this issue.
Well, it's a tough issue. It's an important one, obviously, and one we'll continue to pay attention to. But let's move on now to our hubbubs. Those are the stories that didn't make the front page, that maybe were below the fold, didn't get the attention they might have deserved. Jim, what's your hubbub this week?
Mine fits that very definition. It's on the Metro front. It is below the fold. My colleague Mike Levinson wrote about how South Station might be renamed the Governor Michael S. Dukakis Transportation Center at South Station, which doesn't trip off the tongue quite as easily. And interestingly, the Duke himself was unaware of the effort. It's passed the Massachusetts House, and certainly is going to gain some support in the Senate, I think. But Dukakis said that he didn't know that some of his friends and former colleagues were trying to get this through.
But this is happening, of course, because the former governor, big proponent of transportation and did all kinds of things.
A self-described rail romantic, and he helped renovate South Station, and he's unsatisfied. He's looking for that elusive north-south rail link of a link between North Station and South Station.
All right. John, let's move on to your hubbub.
My hubbub came out in the Chronicle of Higher Education this week, and it's a big takeout on the Belfast Project, which was the oral history of the troubles in Northern Ireland that was being compiled out at Boston College, and ran afoul of some subpoenas that essentially violated the confidentiality that the historian and the researcher or the journalist had promised to these interview subjects. It was all in an effort to bring to light some of the elements of a murder that happened 40 years ago in Northern Ireland. And basically, this article says that it's a tale of grand ambition undermined by insular decision-making and careless oversight. And basically, these materials are lost now. We're not going to get to profit from the history that they collected in this series of interviews, a series of almost 50 interviews. So it's a very comprehensive, very interesting, fascinating, kind of sad story.
Really interesting. I had a look at that at the Chronicle of Education. It's well worth a read. Thanks for bringing that one up, John. So here's my hubbub. It's about the Harvard Business School and the way it treats women. You might recall that about 5 months ago, the New York Times did a big front page story about the fact that Harvard Business School, and most business schools for that matter, remain male-dominated in the makeup of student, faculty, even in the subject of course materials and case studies. Well, this week, the dean of the Harvard Business School, Nitin Noria, acknowledged the problem, offered an apology, kind of an extraordinary one, for the school's past behavior toward women. He told HBS alumni and guests in San Francisco that there were times when women at Harvard felt disrespected, left out, and unloved by the school. He said, "I'm sorry on behalf of the business school. The school owed you better, and I promise it will be better." And among his promises, to double the number of case studies in which women are the protagonists and to continue raising the percentage of women entering Harvard Business School. So change can be slow, but credit to Dean Noria for acknowledging a problem that that was there, that is there.
Maybe they should make themselves a case study.
There you go. John Carroll, professor of communications at Boston University. He writes the Campaign Outsider blog. John, have a great weekend, and thanks for joining
us. Thanks, you too, Anthony.
And Jim O'Sullivan, politics editor at the Boston Globe. Jim, have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too, Anthony.
And thanks again to Nancy Gertner, who joined us earlier. Stay with us. Coming up, the state moves forward on licensing pot distribution dispensaries in Massachusetts. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.